Tonight, we start with tragic news. Melissa Inouye, a respected scholar, author, wife, and mother, has passed away at the age of 44. Melissa's contributions were significant. She attended Harvard, received a degree in East Asian studies, went on to complete a doctorate in 2011 in East Asian languages and civilization. She was a senior lecturer on modern Chinese history at the University of Auckland. She was part of initiating the Global Mormon Studies Research Network and was an advisory board member of the Neil A. Maxwell Institute for Religious Scholarship. I interviewed Melissa way back in 2014 regarding LDS church culture. She was a bridge builder, and her work will have a long-lasting effect far into the future. Mormonism lost an important scholar too young, and she will be missed. Our thoughts here at the Mormon Newscast and condolences go out to her friends and her family, her husband Joseph McMullen, and their four children.
Welcome to the groundbreaking news program that delves into the heart of Mormonism, your weekly window into the unique intersection of news, history, and culture that resonates with the tapestry of Mormonism. So whether you're tuning in from the heart of Utah or joining us from around the world, your favorite news program starts now, where news meets insight and the stories of our faith unfold.
Welcome, everybody, to the Mormon Newscast. It is Monday night, 6 p.m. Mountain Time where I am, and it is April 29th. And thank you so much, Bill, for beginning with that tribute. That was wonderful. That is quite a loss that I think everybody is going to feel for quite some time. So thank you for that. I'm Rebecca Biblioteca. I am joined by two of the most important voices in podcasting today, the amazing Radio Free Mormon. How are you tonight, Radio Free?
I'm great. Thank you so much for the introduction, Rebecca.
And of course, Bill Real. How are you?
Awesome. Having a great week. And we're off to a great start here with Monday.
I think we are. Can we put up our slide that shows us, gives us a little preview of everything that we're going to talk about, and then we'll dive right in. So our stories tonight are going to include David Archuleta flourishing, talking a little bit about what he's been doing lately in his future. We're also going to be talking about LDS NDEs. That's a lot of acronyms, but RFM is going to talk us through those. And then we're going to end up by talking about crunching the word count from General Conference a few weeks ago. So I think we're going to start out with Bill and his story on David Archuleta.
Former American Idol star David Archuleta has reported finding new happiness after leaving the LDS faith. Embracing his identity openly, Archuleta expresses a sense of flourishing and contentment. His journey from a Mormon upbringing to openly embracing his queer identity brought on a tension and an eventual awareness that not only did he not fit in, but that trying to fit in his humanity into the LDS Church's expectations of queer members added weight that became almost too much to bear. But the real story here is a segment of Latter-day Saints who, watching from afar, have decided for David that he can't really be happy, and that they are, in fact, sad for him, that he has made a terrible decision to leave, and that they can tell he has lost the spirit and the light in his eyes. I, for one, always find it a strange thing when others feel competent to know more about you, your feelings, and your journey than you do. I learned years ago that people's stories are sacred and that we have no right to impose that someone is unhappy when they claim to be so, or to decide that someone has fallen when they report flourishing. Latter-day Saints have been taught that the happiness of non-members, especially those who leave the faith, couldn't possibly be real happiness, that any path that doesn't include becoming a more faithful, loyal Mormon is the wrong path, one full of sin and damnation. A segment of believing Mormons are only happy when you are leaving someone else's church and coming into or thriving in the LDS faith and have little capacity to be happy for another's life going well when such is not aligned with the religion. Or to validate the flourishing of another who turns down the opportunity to be LDS, and even more noticeably when one steps away from the faith, claiming they are better off and healthier outside of it. In regards to the image on the screen, I know Latter-day Saints who will say that the critics of the church do the same thing. They leave and they speak ill of the believers. Except that's not true. Unlike the believer who speaks ill of the person who steps away, the critic speaks out against the system and its unhealthy mechanisms. I have never spoke ill of the members. They are my friends and family. Just 2 weeks ago, I learned of a friend who returned to the faith. His reasons for returning don't make logical sense to me. I can't comprehend how he worked around the issues that he self-admits are still major problems to move back into Mormon faithfulness. But I have no desire to badmouth him, to claim he isn't happy, or to assume I know what is best for him. Rather, I work around the clock to shine a light on the unhealthiness of Mormonism generally, and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints specifically, as I think doing such is extremely helpful to those who sense that something is in fact really unhealthy here. That's a huge difference from attacking people in the pews who continue to share their faith, or the folks who have gotten up from those pews and walked away and have spoke up about how that faith hurt them. Might I suggest that for believers who feel inclined to speak ill of those who leave, step back. Recognize you have been raised to have a persecution complex. To see those who come into your faith as worthy of celebration and validation, but those who leave, to see them with disgust and denial of claims of such being good for them. That says nothing about them and everything about you. If someone speaks ill of your religious system, then address it on that level. Either tackle with them the complaints they have or testify of the happiness, joy, and support your system has provided you. But don't make it personal. You are not your religion, and an attack on your system isn't an attack on you. No more than someone pointing out the flaws or abuse of the Rotary Club or the Kiwanis Club is an attack on a member of the Rotary Club or a member of the Kiwanis who they themselves didn't exhibit the flaw or help carry out the abuse. So David Archuleta no longer believes in Mormonism. Okay. So David Archuleta has left Mormonism. All right. David says he is happier, more connected, and is flourishing. I say congratulations to him. I'm happy for him. And you should be too. And I do the same for my friend Landon. Congrats, Landon. If you are happy, I am happy for you. And I celebrate your living your life the way you choose and value your happiness and flourishing so much more than my need for validation that your faith system is unhealthy. Of course we are still friends. Why wouldn't we be? My friends and loved ones believe all kinds of things that I can't bring myself to believe. What I think about your religion is a separate issue than what I think about you. And for those who speak ill of David and others who leave, maybe you could consider the value of having such a perspective.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's great. I think we've all been following David Archuleta's journey. Did you guys watch American Idol back in 2008 when he took, you're like, no. Nope. My kids and I watched that. We followed the whole thing and he was just wonderful. And of course, then we followed him as he decided to sort of put his career, which was absolutely skyrocketing after American Idol, on the back burner and to serve an LDS mission. And at the time, I remember thinking, you know, this is going to definitely make him a darling of the church. Right? He made the right choice. He chose the mission over more worldly pursuit. I mean, his career was really, really getting going after that, after American Idol. He chose to serve a mission and then he came back and then he was, I would say, sort of a darling of the church. He did a lot of things in the church. He performed. He was definitely a celebrity in the LDS world. And then you start reading things about, you know, he's experiencing some changes in his life or some changes of heart, or he has some questions and you see the reception of him sort of becoming a little more lukewarm. And then he actively and vocally by singing steps away from everything. And then you see, you know, people really seem to turn on him, even on an institutional level. I remember, I believe it was it Pat Holland's funeral? It was someone's funeral where he came out and said, I wasn't able to sit, you know, I was kind of relegated to the back, sort of a thing. So, you know, it's not surprising then that when you sense that treatment and you feel that from an institution that you loved so much, that then you start making your feelings more known, more vocally. His song that came out, his video that just came out, which is just incredible. That video is amazing. It really portrays his mother and that idea where we do exactly the opposite of what Bill just described in the video. We embrace people. We love them where they are. It doesn't matter if they've left, if they stay, who they are, we still love them. That's what matters. So it's such a juxtaposition to see how he's being treated. I even read a social media post about his performance on American Idol. He was asked to come back this season and perform his latest song, Held Together. And people said, oh, the light has not only gone out of his eyes, but also out of his voice. He can't sing. You know, they're just criticizing every aspect of who he is. And as you said, Bill, it's simply because he believes differently than you do now. That is not the way that you treat another human being. So, and I commend him for standing up and seeming to just be above it all and being a great person. What do you think, RFM? Have you followed this very much?
Well, I've lived some of it. And the part that I've lived is being a singing sensation back in my youth and having a number of top one hits under my real name. But no, actually, I haven't done that. But what I have done is, having been a Mormon, having lived through this process of so identifying myself with Mormonism that I could not allow myself to hear anything negative about the church, because it became interpreted by myself as an attack on me, because I am so much a Mormon. Any critique of Mormonism becomes an attack on me. And so I remember coming to a point, and this is still back in the 80s, in my 20s, when I started to realize, basically because of the example of others, that it was more healthy to look at my religious beliefs with an arm's length kind of thing. I can see it better. I can be a little bit more academic about it. And I don't have to associate it with me, so I can look at criticisms more impartially. I can actually allow myself to hear them. And this is the problem that's going on. It's the flip side of the other side of the coin, which is where members of the church get so excited when somebody famous joins the or even somebody not so famous. Recently, we've got examples, 3Ds. We got David Boyce, Mr. 52 Churches, who after going out and looking at every religion under God's heaven, he decides to join Mormonism. And the Mormons are in a state of ecstasy over this, because obviously if a guy looks at 52 churches and picks Mormonism, he must be right. Then there's David Alexander, who presents himself as having been an evangelical pastor. He joins the LDS church. People are going crazy. They love this stuff. God help these people if they leave the church, because the same people who are going to be applauding them are going to be criticizing them vociferously if they choose to leave. I mean, back in the 70s, do you remember when Steve Martin was a member of the church, Rebecca?
I was just going to bring that up. Yes, really? Absolutely. There, I was there after you finished speaking, of course. But yeah, because there was a rumor that he had joined the church. And I actually think I helped to start that rumor. Unbelievably, I worked at BYU in the library and a woman there said, oh my gosh, my daughter just sent me a letter and she's tracked it out Steve Martin. She's on her mission in LA and he's going to join the church. So I told two friends, everyone else in our department told two friends. And then of course the daughter wrote back later. This is before you could call every week and said, I was just kidding, mom, his name is Steve Martin, but it's not the Steve Martin. So I've often wondered if that originating at BYU in my department is what started that rumor, because a lot of people believed it.
Well, now we know. I confessed it here. And baseless rumor you originated.
It was me.
Yeah, it was probably you. But yeah, we heard this stuff. I mean, this is back at a time when we had Donnie and Marie. They were actually Mormons, but Mormons they love this stuff so much that they will actually create celebrities, Mormonness, like Steve Martin, who never has been and never was and probably never will be a Mormon, but he was super famous at the time. So we want to hook our name to that because that makes us feel better about ourselves. The other thing that I wanted to mention, oh, that Landon, that guy who went back to church, Bill, was that Landon Brophy, Rebecca?
You know, I read that. Sometimes we don't talk very often, except for on the podcast. If he did go back to church, I feel like I'm going to have to audition new co-hosts. Everybody, call me.
I think he got baptized in Japan.
I don't know.
That's where he is right now, I understand. Yeah.
He is in Japan on work. That's true. So who knows what he's doing? He could have gotten baptized, but I kind of doubt it.
I baptized a few people in Japan.
How many people did you baptize, RFM?
Look, righteous missionaries do not keep track of the number of people they baptize. 33.
That's pretty impressive. I thought it was a really low number, and that's why you were saying we don't keep track, but I'm impressed.
One for each year of the life of Christ.
That's what I was shooting for.
There you go. You nailed it.
Oh, Bill, do you have anything else to add to that story? I'm glad that you brought it up. If you were finished, RFM, were you finished?
I was just saying, pardon the pun, to Bill saying, you nailed it.
Yeah. The only thing I would add is sort of just to reiterate one little point. People, RFM hit it. When people come into the church, we throw parties. We ask them to give talks. We celebrate them. And all they did was they got some information. They made a decision in their brain that they believed something. Maybe they had an experience and they left whatever. They left their old life, which often includes some other church, and they come into Mormonism and it's all good and happy and in celebration. And when that same person, out of the integrity of their conscience, makes the similar kind of decision, gets new information and decides this isn't what it claimed to be, and they step away, the treatment of them is something other than what they got coming in. And I'm simply suggesting that Mormonism is one religion among a million religions on the planet at the present. I know I'm exaggerating the number, but among a whole lot, more than we can count, and more by the day. And across time, the number of religions that have begun and died is so numerous, again, we couldn't count them. And here's this moment in time where someone's making the best decision their brain tells them to make, and we impart judgment and shame and condemnation. And I think we can all do better than that on all sides for that matter, but from the believing side in particular.
It is difficult to recognize why it is that we react that way as faithful Mormons who are taught better principles than that. But I think psychologically, it's because we identify so much with Mormonism that a person, especially a famous person, leaving the church is interpreted as a personal attack on every TBM individually.
And I agree, RFM, that we've been taught better principles as Latter-day Saints, and we've also had leaders who have given us permission to add judgment and shame and condemnation.
I think you flashed a few of those statements up there on the screen during your piece, didn't you?
They were there.
Yeah, and it's all about the validation. You know, if someone famous, someone well-known joins your religion, you're validated. I remember, I think a year or so ago, maybe you know more than I do, a NFL player joined the church. A pretty well-known NFL player. And I remember I saw the article come out and I went over to his Wikipedia page and it already said a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It was that quick. They had updated it that fast. His baptism had just happened the day before. It was in all the major papers. And I just on a whim went, I wonder if they update Wikipedia to show, you know, that this person has joined. And there it was. I don't know if they update it as quickly, whoever they is, when somebody leaves. I'm not sure if they do. But I thought that was kind of interesting that they definitely want to make everybody aware this person, this well-known person, has chosen us.
Was that Merlin Olsen?
No, that would be really long time ago. And we're not talking about Little House on the Prairie. No,
this was another big thing for the Mormons back in the 70s. Merlin Olsen, he's a Mormon. Merlin Olsen.
He was the big one. That's right. I know someone in the chat is going to say who it is. It was a very well-known NFL player who joined.
And Gordon Jump.
Can't remember. Gordon Jump, the Maytag man, and Peter in the Temple film. Yes, that's exactly right. Well, think about just the rumor that, and now I can't pronounce this rapper's name. It was Young Something NBA. You know who I'm talking about.
I have no idea who you're talking about. And I'm happy to say that, actually.
We just looked at this article last week. Everybody was really excited that he was talking about joining the church. It was about a year ago. And I mean, I don't know that he ever joined. It was in the Deseret News that he was talking about joining. He moved here to Utah. Do you know who I'm talking about? And then just recently, there's another article where he might be in some trouble with the law. So you don't really cover that, but you do cover the part where he is thinking, entertaining, and telling others that he's going to join the church.
Well, it wasn't that long ago that the huge rumor out there was Snoop Dogg was a Mormon, and there's a picture circulating of him holding or reading a copy of the Book of Mormon. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yep. No, and that goes, think about all the rumors about who owns a Book of Mormon and who loves the Book of Mormon, right? Elvis apparently died reading the Book of Mormon. It was on his bedside table. That would be an interesting episode for somebody to take on, because there are a lot of people that have been given a Book of Mormon or are rumored to have the Book of Mormon and treasure the Book of Mormon.
Elvis was probably deep in 2 Nephi when he was on the crapper, because this is the first example of 2 Nephi actually killing someone.
Oh my goodness. Yep. No, I do have some insider information on that, you know, supposed rumor that it might actually be true. Somebody that was there when supposedly Olive Osmond handed it to him in Vegas. Mm. So,
oh, sure. Absolutely. You have a rumor right and witnesses will come forward to swear their name to it.
Oh, here you go. Look, Bill pulled it
look
up.
At that, look at his eyes. He's ponderizing that.
He
too.
Looks mesmerized.
I think he's in 2 Nephi as well. Yeah. It's a hell of a trip, man.
I don't know. People read the book. So, all right. I think we've covered this, and we absolutely wish David Archuleta the best of luck. I met him one time. I think I've mentioned before that I used to sing in the Deborah Bonner Unity Gospel Choir, and we did a fireside once, and we were told we are going to be singing with a special guest. We weren't told who it was. And at the very last minute, some security guards came in and they ushered David in, and he sang a song and he gave a fireside, and we got to kind of rub elbows a little bit with him. And he was just a wonderful, wonderful person. So,
okay. Truth or dare, Rebecca, when they introduced David Archuleta, did you shriek and squeal?
No, I did not. You know, it was my kids that really, really loved him. So, but he did give a really interesting fireside, and he did talk all about making the decision to serve the mission instead of follow his career. And he mentioned having several managers say, why are you doing this? What? Who does this? You know, right at that trajectory. And he talked about, you know, the feelings that he had in making the decision to serve a mission. So it was fireside.
See, is that a dog I see in your screen?
Uh-oh. Is there a dog?
You have a dog.
Here's the secret to podcasting. Everybody has a pet. Everyone does.
Can you hold your dog up and introduce the dog to the audience?
Oh, I don't know. This is actually my son's dog. It's my granddog. Oh, look, she's growling. Her name is Alice. Yeah. And on the other side. You guys know what I'm talking about in the audience, right? You have your dogs around you. You just do. It's how it is. So yeah, this is my grand dog, and I'll try to keep her out of the screen because I know it's distracting. So,
Well, you were at a fireside with David Archuleta, and I attended a fireside. It might have been right before or right after I got baptized, where Randy Bachman spoke down at the Puyallup Steak Center.
Really?
Which is in Sumner, Washington, but it was Puyallup Steak, and that's where they have the Steak Center. Okay. Randy Bachman, you know who that is, Bill?
Yes, but I don't know the specific, but it was something from like a decade and a half ago or 2 decades ago.
Or four or five.
Like four
decades. I was going to say it was a long time, but anyway.
Randy Bachman put the B in BTO.
Yeah.
Bachman Turner Overdrive, taking care of business.
Okay. Taking care of business every day.
That's where
the newscast jumps the shark. There we go. That's it.
Where all the kids, all the young boys, right, who were forced to wear dress shoes to these dances. And of course, the stomping that has to occur when they're singing the chorus of Taking Care of Business, leaving all these black marks on the gym floor. I'm convinced that the custodians, back when we had them, the custodians hated that song more than any other.
That's so funny. Yeah, well, and before that, it was Paul H. Dunn, right? He was always out on the circuit. So there's always some kind of celebrity that's going to be speaking.
We have, who is it? Brad Wilcox?
We have Brad Wilcox. Yeah.
He's like a poor man's Paul H. Dunn.
Keith Erickson, the director of church history.
Yeah. Oh, Steve Young often talks to people. So they do still bring people out. It's important. So,
yes.
All right. I think we've covered it. And
we beat that horse.
Much more. That's right. All right. Let's move on to Radio Free Mormon's story. He's going to be talking about NDE. And if you don't know what that acronym stands for, he's going to tell us.
Okay. This is NDE, not ND. It comes from a recent episode of Mormon Land, which is put out under the auspices of the Salt Lake Tribune. It features It features Peggy Fletcher Stack and David Noyce. This is from April 24th with guest historian Matthew Bowman. He's written a few books before. He's written a new book. But he's the director of Mormon Studies at Claremont Graduate University in Southern California. I think he took the place of Patrick Mason when Patrick Mason moved to the University of Utah. Anyway, with all that background, they're going to talk about NDAs and Mormon apocalypticism.
NDEs.
No, I meant NDAs.
Oh,
no. Okay. NDEs. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
That's okay. So I'm going to move. I can move these. So these are some notes I made. Actually, no, this is not the notes. This is actually from the synopsis that somebody else did. Okay. As long as I'm giving attribution where attribution is deserved, I feel I can sleep at night. All kinds of believers and non-believers have described brushes with death, in which they briefly left their bodies to see and feel otherworldly elements. While most scientists say these near-death experiences, which is what NDE stands for, by the way, are the product of neurons firing in particular ways under particular stress, like, I'm dying, many who are religious view them as objective encounters. In other words, they really happen, occurring in space and time. Members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints seem particularly intrigued by the way such experiences affirm their teachings of the afterlife and have rushed to buy the many books on the topic, including Betty Eady's 1992 bestseller, Embraced by the Light. How many people out there remember that book?
I read it.
Did you really?
I did. And
I
was. I
never read it. What did you think about it, Bill?
It was a non-Mormon psychic lady who shared her near-death experience, and it was not perfectly aligned with the Mormon idea, but it was much closer to Mormonism's afterworld than any other religion that I was familiar with or still am.
Okay, that's fascinating. I never read it. I was vaguely aware it was going on, but I'm basically doing my TBM stuff. And this was hugely popular among Mormons, non-Mormons. She's on Oprah. It's a big bestseller. So I'm glad that you read it and you can tell us what it was about. So there's a picture of Betty Eady. She looks very happy that she's written a bestseller. And there's the book, Embraced by the Light, a New York Times bestseller indeed. And then, according to Matthew Bowman, as he's interviewed on this Mormon Land episode, Embraced by the Light was hugely popular because the NDE narrative also reflected the New Age movement, which was big in the 90s, of healing crystals and auras, so prevalent in the 1990s. But in 2012, a very different sort of NDE book hit the bookstores. Visions of Glory. And this is just the 5-year anniversary. So this is apparently a 2017 edition. Already over 100,000 copies sold. Massively, massively popular. And here's the individual who wrote it. Tom Harrison, that's T-H-O-M. Tom Harrison, who published Visions of Glory under the nom de plume, John Pontius. And John Pontius is writing as if he's relating the experiences of another guy who goes by the sobriquet of Spencer. Now, these NDEs end up being things where, of course, you die, you have some kind of spiritual experience, you encounter some kind of spiritual beings oftentimes. And what frequently happens more and more now is not that, oh, wow, this is cool because there's life after death and I feel this sense of, you know, comfort and love and I got hugged and everything, and everything's going to be fine after you die, so you don't have to worry so much about it. But they start now being exercises in the individual who has the NDA speaking or being spoken to by these divine personages, having special, sacred, divine truths revealed to them, which they then bring back with them when they once again enter their body, and they can start writing books and giving talks. And now they're telling everybody about what they experienced, what they were told, what they saw, which has the added layer of authority of this guy knows because he's getting it directly from angels and Jesus and God. And on top of that, what ends up happening in this book is that it goes into, I haven't read it, by the way. I hope to at some point when I feel like I really need to get cultified in this. But it talks about the last days and apocalypticism and what's going to happen. And on top of that, let me go ahead and go to the next slide, which is very, very disturbing. Visions of Glory has the NDE theme, but combines it not with healing so much as with third wave Pentecostalism. It's an adoption of this whole idea that's out there, this whole theology that already exists, and it's being brought into Mormonism through books like Visions of Glory, which is concerned with spiritual warfare, demonic possession, and the last days, the signs of the times, and what's going to happen and when it's going to happen. But Tom Harrison's Visions of Glory, influenced by third wave Pentecostalism, developed out of charismatic Christianity. It's very interested in exorcism and spiritual warfare. The earth is infested with evil spirits, dark spirits, demons. And there is a very real spiritual struggle going on all around us all the time. And it's very important for human beings to understand this and get involved. These reflect my notes made on the interview. But that's what's going on. So it makes it immediate to people. It makes the stakes very high. It also puts you on an inner circle if you have these experiences. And it leads to a lot of bad things in a lot of cases that we know about in Mormonism. I don't know about all the things that might be happening in Pentecostalism as a result of this, but I expect there must be some bad stories there as well. Critical scenes in Visions of Glory. A critical scene is that Spencer, remember the guy who's supposed to be relating these experiences, Spencer sees a man being assaulted by evil spirits. Some of these spirits are dead. They're of dead people. Some are unbodied, not born. They surround this person and direct him to watch pornography. Every time I say that, I think of the way Homer Simpson said it. Pornography. And they crawl inside his body as he is doing this in order to take over his body, which, if you're not careful, can lead you to this. And that, for those people who are listening and not watching this or may not know who these people are, you got Chad Daybell, you've got Lori Vallow, and you got her two kids that they killed. And let me go ahead and rephrase that. The two kids that Lori has been convicted of killing and the two kids that Chad Daybell is now accused of and on trial for having killed. This all comes from Tom Harrison. It all comes from Visions of Glory. It all comes from this kind of third wave Pentecostalism that has made its way into the church. Chad Daybell is a critical figure. This is also notes from this interview that I made. Very important in the prepper community and then in energy work and spiritual warfare. Energy work is not completely absent. It's just sort of subsumed, takes a second place to the spiritual warfare. Chad Daybell says he did have a press, Spring Hill Books, and his own works were based on his near-death experiences, which he claimed to have as a young man. Some of them, he's had more since. And apparently he had a vision of the World Trade Center burning, which was published in the year 2000. So obviously he's a true prophet, just like Gene Dixon. You get close with one out of 1,000 and you're in, baby. You're a true prophet. Here's a couple of the books he wrote using his press, Living on the Edge of Heaven and The Great Gathering. And he wrote many, many more. Chad also published others using his press, right? Including Julie Rowe. Julie Rowe comes to NDEs from energy work and manipulating people's auras and combating dark energy. So she's more on that healing thing, but now she's hooked up with the prepper movement and the apocalyptic stuff, right? After her divorce, she becomes interested in the apocalyptic community and has visions as to how the end times are going to happen. She's been spectacularly wrong each and every time, as far as I know. Has Jesus come back yet, Rebecca? Did that happen on April 8th, or did I miss it?
You know, it's just sort of a little dicey. So he didn't come back that all the rest of us can see, but I do know certain groups kind of fringe in Mormonism that feel that he's here, but very low key. Like he's meeting with the brethren. He sort of pops in, pops out, laying all the groundwork. And then eventually he will show up kind of fired out of a volcano, maybe in a bright red robe. And the rest of us will then find out. Yes. Yes, RFM.
Would someone please get word to these people that if Jesus is showing up in these secret meetings, okay, well, would someone remind these people that Jesus in the New Testament said, if someone says that Jesus has come back and he's in the desert, don't believe him. Or if someone says Jesus has come back and he's in the secret chambers, don't believe them. Because when he comes back, it's not going to be a secret. Everybody's going to see it. As the sun shines from the east unto the west will be the coming of the Son of Man. So don't try and tell us this stuff like you guys are the ones who have the secret knowledge. And yeah, we know because we saw him, but nobody else gets to see him except for us because we're so special. Take our word for it. That's not the way it's predicted is happening. Could you let him know that, Rebecca? Do you know any of these people?
You know, I'm just not going to say anything, but I might. And I do know that they do get confirmation of their point of view from conference, which is something I'm going to talk about later. They definitely look for words and phrases that are signs from the brethren that this is happening. You know, things yes. that they know that we don't know. And they're trying to tell certain people through certain verbiage what's actually happening.
Yes. And I think that part of that verbiage is covenant path. And every time you say covenant path, it represents at least one time that you've seen Jesus. Wow. Bill, I've been leaving you out of this. I apologize. I was laughing at Rebecca because we had a conversation earlier today about this very subject. And that's why I was asking her, do you know any people who believe this stuff about Jesus came back on April 8th, but it's a big secret?
I've heard you guys talk about it. I've heard little rumblings when the eclipse was happening, but I have no clue about this. And I think, just for the record, every single person in Mormonism or out who has predicted that Jesus will come back and named when have been wrong. Everyone, including what will turn out to be President Nelson, who several years ago said we are in the 11th and a half hour, which now limits, at least mathematically, to the ability to sort of pinpoint how much time now is left. And he will be wrong too.
Well, I'm sure if there's any official prediction of when Jesus comes back and he doesn't show up, it'll be our fault.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go on to the next slide. Oh, there's Julie Rowe. There she is. She looks very happy. And these are some books that she published. The New Revolution, A Vision of America's Future, and it's not looking good. Then there's The Julie Rowe Show, hosted by Eric Smith. And they've got podcasts 1 through 10 that you can find on the internet. Chad Daybell and Julie Rowe end up being very influential together. And they influence Ruby Frankie and Jody Hildebrandt, as well as others, especially as to the possession and spiritual warfare. Same for Chad Daybell and Lori Vallow. And there they are. There's Ruby Frankie and... what is it? Hildebrandt. Jody. Right. How could I forget her name? Jody Hildebrandt. And it's interesting that before they were living in prison, they're living in a different space. And that space has to do with spiritual possession, demonic possession, and corporal punishment used as a means of trying to drive out demons from children. And it just strikes me that Jody Hildebrandt, inhabiting this space, should be aware that Jody, even her name, has certain connotations within this area. You may remember this movie. Does anybody remember this movie? And can you name the actors?
This is a terrifying
movie. Movie first.
Oh, the Amityville Horror?
The Amityville what?
Horror.
Oh, horror. Okay, yes. Yeah, that's what I thought you said.
Yes, no, I didn't say, I said horror.
Right, the Amityville Horror. And Bill, do you know
that might be something you watched, RFM, that, you know, I didn't watch that.
I watched it in the theaters when it came out.
I can't tell who the male actor is, and I can't name the female, but I definitely know who that is. I just can't name her.
Okay, do you know who Josh Brolin is?
Mm-mm.
Okay, well, this is James Brolin anyway.
Okay, so it wasn't Josh regardless. So.
No, are they related? I don't know. Somebody can tell me, but this is James Brolin and... the chick who made the one movie after Superman. She was Lois Lane.
Oh, Lois Lane. That's where I remember her from.
What's her name?
Karen Allen? No. That's
Raiders.
Someone's saying Margot Kidder.
Margot. Oh,
Margot Kidder.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you, Margot Kidder.
That's right.
Okay. So there was a demon in this house that possessed James Brolin, who is, it's based on a true story, or at least, you know, there were murders that occurred. I can't vouch for whether there was demonic possession involved. But and it was at this house, I believe. And the demon in the story manifested itself. Do you remember how? As a pig. Don't you remember that there's a pig that was seen and the name of the pig was... Oh, yeah, that's the Amityville Horror. It was written into a book by Jay Anson. Yeah. The Kansas City Star says, this book will scare the hell out of you.
It's terrifying.
There's the pig. The name of the pig is Jody. This is what this is all leading up to. I'm trying to do something creative that wasn't in the article or in the notes from the interview. But yes, Jody, and I'm not trying to say that Jody Hildebrandt is poor seen, okay? I'm not trying to make any kind of comparison visually. I'm just saying that a person who does this kind of stuff for a living has got to know that there's a very famous Jody in this field of, I almost said research. Well, we'll call it research, in this field. And Jody is the demon pig from the Amityville Horror. And maybe this is fiction. What? Life imitating art.
That's terrifying. Did you make that with AI?
I would love to say that I did, but no, I did not. You still got to teach me how to do the AI stuff.
I'm working on
it. I drew this myself. That's what I should have said. But I didn't. And I think there's a little name under there at the bottom right of probably who did that.
Something.
So yeah, the other thing that was mentioned, I didn't have a slide about it, that Matthew Bowen wanted to emphasize was how pervasive these ideas are in Mormonism. He said, by and large, if a regular Mormon reads this, they might think some of the ideas are interesting, but there's a big and growing community of people who think it's more than interesting. They think it's real, and they're patterning their lives about it, and they're disciplining their children according to it, and sometimes they're burying their children because of it, or spending time, long stretches in prison because of it. And yet, I'm going to say it again. I said it before when we talked about this. The silence from church leadership on the issue is deafening. So that's that. I think that's the end of the story. And then we go to, it says Rebecca.
It does. But first,
Rebecca, what do you think about this story? And actually, I keep asking you first. Bill, what do you think about this story? Then we'll go to Rebecca.
Well, I'll just say two things. In regards to NDEs, my wife has always had a very big fascination with them up until when she no longer believed in God 5 years ago or so. And so she would read NDE books. I was looking, when I stepped away from the screen, folks will notice I took myself off the screen for a minute. I went to my bookshelf because I used to own both of these and I've thrown out so much material. But these are two NDE books that were written by an LDS author. The stories all have a connection to Mormonism. And again, you pointed this out earlier. I know this isn't the main gist of the story, but Mormons love NDE experiences that match Mormon theology because it is an evidence that the church is true. It doesn't matter that there have been hundreds and thousands of other people who have had NDEs that say something completely different religion, don't happen in the same way. But Latter-day Saints, if they can get onto an NDE that looks and smells and sounds like a Mormon NDE, they're tickled pink.
Bill, have you read any of these books?
I have. I read Echoes of From Eternity. I read about 2/3 of it. And then Glimpses of Eternity, I read like 5 or 6 stories out of it.
Well, they're both titled New Near-Death Experiences Examined. In any case in which a near-death experience is examined in either of these books that you read, were any of them concluded to have been made up?
No, although I know most NDEs have turned out to be made up. The ones that have been made into big movies or books, I should say. But I will say this guy was very selective. He only put NDEs together that had a Mormon echo to them, hence Echoes from Eternity, which was the first book.
And that kind of selectivity, it's just that when you're saying you're examining something, I would expect that if the examination is thorough enough, at least one would end up being not real.
No, these are all real.
Got it. And you know, I want to go to Rebecca here in a second, but something was mentioned in this interview that I thought was interesting is he identifies really the inception of this idea of having the NDEs cataloged in a book started with a very famous book by Dwayne Crowther, which I read, called Life Everlasting. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that one? Maybe you can find a picture of that, Bill. I read that. I thought it was great. You know, and that's where I learned through people's NDEs that the spirit actually hangs around the body for a little while after the decease. And therefore, you need to be careful what you say because they're right there listening. You know, they're right there for some time. Now, Rebecca's laughing. And why are you laughing about that, Rebecca? There it is, Life Everlasting.
No, I'm laughing.
I had this one that was up there. It's second from the left on the top. That's an earlier one. That's the one that I had.
Yeah, that's very famous.
That page, that cover, Life Everlasting. Let me know if you've heard about that in the live chat or if you've read it as well. But this was identified as being one of the earliest NDE books in Mormonism. So what do you think about that story about spirits hanging around the body for a bit after they die, Rebecca?
I'm laughing so I don't cry because a lot of you, I might've mentioned before that my dad passed away a couple of weeks ago and my mom is a proponent of all this kind of stuff. And she told me that, you know, she goes, you gotta be really careful. You gotta be quiet when it happens. A spirit, you know, she kind of like scripted the whole final moments based on some of these books, you know, and I just kind of dismissed it, but it was a little, I don't know. It was a little disturbing that even in the last moments of my dad's life, it's still prescripted by these books, you know, these things that I, of course, don't believe are real at all, but a lot of members of my family do. So that's kind of, I was laughing so I wouldn't cry. I guess maybe that's what it was. But yeah. I will say with the NDEs, so much was made of these last fall with Tim Ballard. He'd had one, Chad Daybell. Everybody has to have one in order to have a connection, in order to be important. So the spirits are telling you what to do. And so I did a lot of research into NDEs. I did it. Mormonish did a podcast on it. We looked all into it, the medical side of it, what it really means, why people think it's real. And they do think it's real. It is an experience that you have, you know, sort of in your mind is what we kind of arrived at. The other thing we learned is that whatever religion you are, what you are, you will have that kind of an experience. And so if you're a Mormon, you're probably going to have something that, like you said, has echoes of Mormonism. Although I've yet to come across one where they literally went through what you learn in the temple, what happened at death. I have not come across an experience like that. Maybe you guys have before. But you see what you want to see. And I think about my own mom had an NDE. She was a convert to the church. And so her NDE was more of a Presbyterian. There were pearly gates. There was St. Peter reading from a book. It wasn't a Mormon NDE because all of her upbringing, her whole life had been that Presbyterian where you would see the pearly gates and St. Peter and wings and books and think reading out of a book, telling you it's not your time. That's a very common element of NDEs. Something sends you back. There's work you still need to do and you're extremely important. Now that you've gone back, you can communicate with the other side and you have something very special to do. Now in Chad Daybell's case, he didn't remember his NDE until much later, you know, and it was really important for him to have one so that people would listen to him. So that's an interesting part of it, I think. But when I think about the dark spirits and that kind of element in Mormonism, when I was younger, I felt like that was more prevalent. Like in the early 70s, I heard all the time in Sunday school, there are dark spirits in the world, especially if you drink alcohol, the spirits will come into your body, much like the pornography story that you read. They'll make you do things that you shouldn't do. So there was this kind of sense, I think when I was little, kind of raised that way. This may be more Orthodox Mormonisms that believed in this. Then I feel like that kind of went away a little bit. I don't remember it so much in college or as an older teenager, as a young married person. Then I kind of get the sense that it's coming back. Do you guys feel that way? Just that idea, the apocalypse and the end and the evil spirits. I think it's back with a vengeance.
I agree. And I think that it signifies something about society. Matthew Bowman is trying to link the different kind of NDEs that we're experiencing, like versus the 90s with today, with being a reflection of different kinds of societies in which they're embedded. I think it's probably goes without saying that almost any kind of NDE or anything else is going to be popular to the degree that it reflects what's going on in society. Book of Mormon 2, by the way. So that is basically all that I have to present. And it's Rebecca's turn. Back to you, Rebecca. You've got a great episode piece about word counting.
About word count. Yeah, I kind of made my own news almost this time. I actually came across on social media somebody that had gone to great lengths to crunch the General Conference word count data. And so I communicated with this person. He's somebody named David DeMordant. I hope I'm not pronouncing that incorrectly. But he used... What?
David Montmore.
It could be, but I don't think so.
Okay. That's just a little inside joke.
It was an inside joke. That's right. Anyway, so a lot of you may not be aware, but there is something called the LDS General Conference Corpus. It basically makes all conferences searchable. And so finally, this conference that happened a few weeks ago is there and you're able to search through it. So he makes this disclaimer, which I thought was really cute as we were kind of working together on this. He came up with most of this, but we kind of did back and forth. He said, the observations rest on the reliability of the resource. And that's true. So we're just kind of going to go through pretty quickly. I have a number of slides, but I think it's very telling. And I will explain to you why. So I'm calling this Crunching the General Conference Word Count Data from April of 2024. And the reason we're doing this is because this is from the church's website right here, the statement. It says, in matters of doctrine and church policy, the best sources are, and these would be considered trusted sources. We always talk about trusted sources. These are the sources you can trust: the scriptures, the teachings of the living prophets, and the general handbook. So I have some pictures of the handbook. It used to be that there was only handbook 1 and 2 for leadership, right? I'm sure, Bill, that you probably had a chance to peruse those when you were a bishop, right? More recently, they've made the handbook available to everyone. And of course, I have a picture of the Liahona, used to be known as the Ensign or Ensign, where they put all the conference talks every 6 months. So these are our trusted sources. These are the words that shape our understanding of the gospel and what we're supposed to be living. So words matter. And that's what we're going to talk about. Why do words matter? Words that disappear from use show us what the church wants to distance itself from. And I have a picture here. I have a picture just like this of my own ancestor, but I couldn't find it. So these are some polygamous Mormons who had been arrested back in the day because they're practicing what was known as the principle. So how long has it been in conference since we've heard the word polygamy or plural marriage or anything like that? Again, words disappear when the church is trying to distance itself from something. And then new words are added, show us that the church wants to begin to emphasize something. So I think it's really important to look at this. And we're going to go through a couple of these examples again from my friend David and his post on Reddit and a few more that we came up with and added together. So for the second conference in a row, Dieter Uchtdorf did not quote or mention President Nelson. People think that might be kind of telling. The gold star goes to Matthew L. Carpenter, who mentioned him 5 times in one talk. But no one can compete with Alan Haney, who mentioned him 9 times in one talk during the previous conference. And of course, because it's Mr. Haney, Elder Haney, I had to include this picture because RFM said that every time. Go ahead, say it.
Mr. Haney.
Mr. Haney. So I thought for our viewers, I'd finally put a picture up of this is Mr. Haney, the other Mr. Haney. And now that I'm looking at it, it's pretty funny. They're both kind of making the same motion, aren't they, with their
hands?
They
are. There's a genetic, there's something genetic going on. I like it when Alf imitates Mr. Haney the best.
That's right. So the point is, maybe you can learn something from that. Dieter Uchtdorf did not talk about President Nelson when almost everybody else quoted him and mentioned him. Yes, RFM.
That is significant.
It is significant.
There's no love lost between the pilot and the heart surgeon.
That's what I'm saying. The absence of words is almost as important as some of the words that you find. And that's what we're going to go through here quickly. So, of course, I couldn't do a word crunching segment without including Nemo. Every year for conference, Nemo does what he calls his Jesus, Joe, and Russell countdown, right? And that's how many times somebody mentions Jesus, Joseph Smith, and President Nelson in conference. So this is a very interesting, this is just from April. So Jesus was mentioned 47 times, the name of Jesus or probably the Savior, you know, some mention of Jesus 47 times, Joseph Smith 10 times. That's kind of interesting. And Russell Nelson 65 times. Do you guys find that kind of interesting?
I do, because granting the fact that this is mostly an ass-kissing competition, it seems that the GAs feel the need to ingratiate themselves more with the president of the church than with the Savior of the universe.
That must be it. And we can see that Joseph Smith is trending down. And I think he has been in quite a few conferences. So that's pretty interesting. All right, let's see what else we can gather from the data. Okay, I really wanted to know this. This was important to me. How often was the phrase garment of the holy priesthood used in all the history of general conference? Any guesses?
I have a guess, but we already talked about it. So
we did. Bill, what's your guess?
I looked at the slideshow before the show, so I know the answer.
Dang it. Okay.
I did guess it. I guessed it right before when we were talking, didn't I?
You did. And I think we would all guess the same thing. The answer is never. We have never heard that phrase in all of conference before. So what does that mean? Why was this introduced? And why was it mentioned in April 2024 by Sister J. Annette Dennis, who said it 7 times? As I said before, this is something the church is starting to focus on, the garment of the holy priesthood.
Rebecca, let me ask you, since you did the research, I know that Dallin Oaks made the same reference to wearing your garments. Did he use that expression when he spoke the next day in general conference?
No, nobody says garment of the holy priesthood. This is all we can find. And somebody else can check. Again, this is very easy to go and check. There were mentions of garments throughout history, but it was actually way more sporadic than I would think. There were very few talks where they actually just said, you keep those on. There was one by President Nelson back in, I think it was in the teens, where he said something like that, don't take those off even when you're mowing the lawn. So he seems to be the one that says that. Others just kind of mentioned in passing, you know, your garments are a protection, but nobody has ever said garment of the holy priesthood. So that's a new phrase that I think maybe we'll hear going forward. And I think that was very calculated based on things that were happening, you know, supposedly women not wearing their garments, as we covered, you know, got to make sure it's linked to the priesthood. It's something very important. So again, words matter. I thought this was interesting. The word honesty mentioned in conference. In February of 2023, the SEC announced that the Mormon Church was being fined $5 million for its handling of the Ensign Peak Investment Fund. Then for two conferences in a row, the word honesty mysteriously vanished from all conference speeches. In 2024 April conference, there was one passing mention about growing in patience and honesty. And of course, I have my little AI of, this is my idea of a shell company, right? Some turtles working in an office. So, because we all know about the SEC and the shell companies. But again, the word honesty not mentioned, because I think maybe they realize optically, you can't really talk about that when you're having this problem with the SEC.
I guess honesty really is a lonely word.
I didn't think of saying that. That's very good. So here's a whole list of words that have not been used since the SEC fine. And these words were used in past here and there in conference, just in stories and things. But we were able to check and see that these words were not used at all since the SEC fine. These words would be cheat, fraud, investment, crime, wealth, hypocrisy, hypocrite, riches, talking about material riches, misleading, dishonest, apology, and wealthy. None of those words have appeared in any talks or any addresses in general conference since the SEC fine. So that's kind of interesting to me too. I guess they just don't want people's minds to go there. Is that what you think?
Yeah, and I think not that they would have instructed every speaker of please avoid these words,
right.
But more of even the 70s and the general auxiliary leaders would sort of sense like, let's not use that.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. Like they probably write in their talks, I want to talk about, let's be honest in all our dealings. Something's telling me not to. I agree. I'm sure it happened organically. They're just shying away from that word and those words. So I thought that was really interesting. The phrase choose the right. Now that was a big thing we heard when I was growing up all the time. Everybody had a CTR ring. So in the 90s, and through the 2010s, choose the right was used about 12 times per general conference. We were always told that on the average. It was used 12 times per general conference, and it has since disappeared. They don't say that anymore. Choose the right. And one thing that my new friend David thought is that implies that you have the ability to choose, that you might weigh things and make a decision. Maybe we're moving away from that. I don't know. That's one way to look at it. But choose the right is not appearing in any of the phraseology anymore. So
think celestial.
And we're going to get to that one. That was one of the big ones. Absolutely. Yep. That's being replaced by think celestial. I think you're right. I hadn't made that comparison, but that's a good one. Here's an interesting one. No speaker in the recent general conference used the word translate. They're definitely moving away from that word. Although, as it says on my slide, they use it all the time. Joseph Smith, translated. Here's what he was wearing when he translated, translator. All the curriculum says this, but they're not saying that word in conference anymore. Is this something that they're trying to sort of dial back on? I don't know, but it's not being said. The great apostasy. This is one that RFM, when I was talking to him today, suggested, let's look this one up. I'm telling you, you guys can go down this rabbit hole. It's really fascinating. And I'm sure a lot of you can think of other words that aren't going to be mentioned here that could be very telling. So we looked this one up. RFM actually looked it up himself. And this one has not been mentioned since 2009. And as we know, recently, we've seen some articles in the media, Deseret News, I think more in the Tribune, where they say, we don't really talk about it. We're kind of dialing that back. It didn't really happen. It's not really what we thought. So they're not mentioning it, and they haven't been for about 15 years. So I thought that was really telling. What do you guys think about that one?
we did an episode on it, Mormonism Live.
Yeah,
and
I remember that.
Shared the book that came out of the Maxwell Institute about ancient Christians.
Yeah.
And the Maxwell Institute, the church's academic educational arm of the church, acknowledged that, as you pointed out, the great apostasy, as Mormonism has framed it, has spoke of it as its doctrine and theology, just didn't happen the way they said it did.
Right.
Yeah, that was the early Christians in disarray, I think.
Mm. Yep. Hence my picture. That's Peter being crucified upside down, because that's once all the apostles... What? Sorry.
I'm sorry. I said that's how you can tell it's Peter.
Yeah, because he's upside down. That is how you can tell it's Peter. Yes, because he did not want to be crucified in the same way as Jesus Christ. So he opted for the upside down method. But of course, once all the apostles were killed, then supposedly, at least when I was growing up, that's what we were taught, the entire church was in apostasy for thousands, you know, for centuries.
The power and the keys.
Everything disappeared. The Bible. Yep, that's exactly
the,
right.
The ordinances were changed. The everlasting covenant was broken.
Unchangeable ordinances.
Isaiah 24, 6.
Yeah. And I'm guessing both of you probably taught that on your missions, right? Because do we need a restoration? Of the apostasy. So if there's
Rebecca,
no
that's kind of a sore spot for Bill. He didn't serve.
I didn't go on a mission. I just served as a bishop, RFM.
Yeah. Well, you should actually feel good about the fact you didn't go on a mission.
You know, I knew that. I don't know why I forgot that.
Now, exactly. Not then.
Okay. You, RFM, must have taught this on your mission.
Yes, I did, in Japanese, when I was baptizing 33 people. Yeah.
Exactly. I'm sure you taught each of those 33 people that the reason we needed Joseph Smith, a restoration, is because there was this great apostasy. So what do they say now? No apostasy, no need for a restoration? I mean, that's a pretty crazy leap right there, but they're not talking about it.
Landon just had a comment. Is he in the live chat from Japan?
You know what? I think it's like the middle of the night, but he's there. Hi, Landon.
Landon, all I've got to say to you is, Oyasumi nasai.
There you go. Oh, and he made the comment, now they are using the word ongoing restoration. Yeah.
Right.
Which, that's exactly right.
That's the problem. This is the problem that they have got to figure out a way to deal with. If there's no apostasy, then you don't need a restoration.
Yep.
They're going to write themselves right out of the sales pitch if they keep it up.
Exactly right. And ongoing restoration does seem to, you know, in a way say there just needs to be continual progress. I did sort of a little litmus test with my mom, is in her late 80s. You know, she is a 1980s Mormon. I mean, she is stuck there at that level, which is great. It's comfortable for her. But I mentioned the phrase ongoing restoration. I said, you know, that one of the words that they use now is ongoing restoration to show things are changing. And she said, well, that's not real. That's not a thing. And I go, it is a thing. She's like, that's not real at all. So ongoing restoration, if that's what they're going with, you know, that's one word, a phrase I didn't look up. I wish someone right now who's out there watching or listening would go over to the General Conference corpus and look it up, because I'd be curious to know how often ongoing restoration is used. I didn't even think of
that. Will do that, but I wanted to let you know first, am I still on?
Uh-huh.
Okay. I didn't know if I'd muted myself.
No.
But I did go back and I double checked. And yes, according to the LDS General Conference Corpus website, seven mentions, Garment of the Holy Priesthood, all by J. Annette Dennis in 2024, April's General Conference. Yeah. In fact, in one talk.
Yeah, all in one talk. I'm telling you, this is a fascinating website. Everyone needs to go there. You can learn so much just about, you know, what is the gospel? This is the gospel. As I showed in that second slide, the words of the living prophet. That is the gospel, and it's ever changing. So
what we have here is one mention of ongoing restoration in the 2010s.
Oh,
so let me see when that was. That was 2019.
Dieter Uchtdorf.
I'm sorry.
The first time was, I think, Dieter Uchtdorf, and then
this one shows years later. Cook.
Okay.
In 2019. So once again, this is based upon the putting all the words in there and spelling them all correctly. I'm sure they have a way of doing it. If it's copy and paste, I don't know. But according to what they have here at the LDS General Conference Corpus, the first usage of it was by Quentin Cook in 2019, the ongoing restoration of the gospel. So Cook gets credit for that according to this website. And then, hang on a second here. And then after that, there were, I think, 13 in the last 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Could you check on steeple height or steeples in general and just see if that's ever taught a central tenet of the faith of Mormonism.
Yeah.
Next conference. They'll put that in next.
So 2019, Cook mentions it, Elder Cook. 2020, you get Elder Gong. Gene Bingham, another gong, two eye rings, a Holmes, a Nelson, a Walker, no, two Walkers, a Rasband, a Phillips, and a Brent Nielsen is the most recent in 2024. So it goes from never having been mentioned ever in general conference to being mentioned 14 times in the last 5 years, including the 2019 mentioned by Elder Cook.
Wow. You are seeing the newscast being researched and planned in real time. Here we are. But this website is so fascinating. You can't not look at it. And as I mentioned at the beginning, the words that are starting to mention all the time, that's the direction we're going. The words that they don't mention, that's what we're moving away from. So it's very telling. Okay, Book of Abraham. All right, that's a big one, right? When I was growing up, this was talked about all the time, constantly. Not only was it not mentioned in the 2024 spring session, it hasn't been mentioned or cited in general conference at all since 2014. That's no way to treat the revealed word of God, says our friend David.
That's about the year that the gospel topic essay on the Book of Abraham came out. That's a strange coincidence.
You caught it. That's right. There are problems with the Book of Abraham. People are starting to look at that. This was Landon, my co-host, huge shelf breaker. This is what did it. He was so faithful that he attended a gospel doctrine class, and he was sitting there studying the Book of Abraham, and he said, wait a minute. We have a Rosetta Stone now. We can actually find out what this says. He thought he was the first person who'd ever thought of that. He went home from church. He excitedly Googled Book of Abraham, Rosetta Stone translation. He came up with all the research on BYU that BYU had done. He saw that it wasn't what they had told him that it was. He's very pragmatic. He's like, I'm out. I mean, that's all it took. So good observation, Bill. They just, again, have dialed that back because it's so problematic. Not going to be mentioned anymore.
And I bet that one's not organic. This would have been leaders of the church telling all speakers of conference going forward, please do not mention the Book of Abraham.
Yep. Hard stop. And we see that in the curriculum too. I know that you guys have mentioned that before on different podcasts in the curriculum. They're quoting, you know, different things, but not the Book of Abraham. This is interesting. No speaker in the recent general conference used the word Lamanite or Lamanites. In fact, no one has used that since 1995. And even in that case, they were quoting President Kimball. So that's to be expected. And we know they've been moving away from that word for a long time. But as my friend David points out, it clearly says here in the opening page of the Book of Mormon, this is written for the Lamanites. So, but now they have completely receded. So again, changing the emphasis, very different from those of us growing up in a certain era where it was all about that. So the word covenants, I think all of us, you don't need the general conference corpus to know how much we hear the word covenant. And I put Indiana Jones because I thought Ark of the Covenant. So there were 133 usages of the word covenants, and the use of the word covenants has increased about 30% compared to 10 years ago, and it has doubled compared to 20 years ago. And I'm sure both of you have noticed that, this incredible emphasis on the word covenants.
Looks like Owen Wilson and Indiana Jones had a baby.
It does kind of. This is AI because, you know, I don't want to get a strike. But yeah, it is kind of an interesting look. But I was trying to go for the Ark of the Covenant, of course. So, but you can, it can, it cannot have escaped you guys how much they use that word covenants all the time. Mm. Yeah.
Covenant path.
The covenant path. And we're going to get to that one. So in 2016, there was an average of about 30 usages of the word covenants per conference. In 1989, there was an average of 23 usages per conference, and the numbers are trending backwards, meaning that they did not emphasize or focus on covenants in the past. And if you flip that upside down, it's only increasing the usage of the word covenants, which of course is to bind everybody to the rule following and what you need to do. Covenant path, as Bill just said, covenant path was used 12 times in general conference this spring. And that's my AI of a covenant path. It looks very pleasant, doesn't it?
But all uphill.
Exactly. So, that's a very good point. Since 2020, there have been 190 references to covenant path. But interestingly, for the past 150 plus years, from the first general conference until 2007, there was zero. There were no mentions of the word. And as my friend David says, God hadn't thought it up yet. So that could be true. It's definitely a buzzword and a buzz phrase. So let's find out where it came from. I was really curious because it is something that we say all the time, we hear all the time. In the past conference, Elder Ronald Rasbens credited Russell Nelson with originating the phrase Covenant Path, praising Nelson for having a way with words. Nelson spoke later in the conference and said nothing to dispel Rasbens' false attribution because President Nelson did not come up with the phrase Covenant Path, although he does use it a lot. So where did it come from? So the phrase Covenant Path goes way back to at least 2007 in April General Conference. There was a talk by Sister Elaine S. Dalton, although in her talk when she used the phrase, she was quoting from an article in 2006 from Elder Holland. The article is called What I Wish Every Member Knew, and it uses the phrase twice. So I don't know if that means that Elder Holland actually made up the word or the phrase Covenant Path. It seems like he's one of the very early uses of it. So since I think
that's when he was talking about being with his son in a truck and they were out in the Utah desert
and taking the wrong,
they were following the covenant path. And then it came to a place where it diverged in a wood.
Yeah. I think now we've diverged. I don't think that's quite right. But anyway, in the past conferences, D. Todd Christofferson, Carol M. Stevens, Linda K. Burton, Henry B. Eyring, Gary E. Stevenson, Mary Ann Cook all used that phrase before President Nelson used it. So finally, President Nelson uses the phrase Covenant Path in a 2015 talk. 200.
That's a Freudian slip.
Sorry. When you're talking about octogenarians, your mind goes up with the numbers. Yeah, that's what happened.
He was talking about the ongoing apostasy back in 215.
There's too many numbers and words in this dang presentation. I'm losing it. So
that was when he was a junior apostle.
That's exactly right. Okay, so a 2015 talk, he said it. And then in 2018, who can forget his inaugural address to the members of the church as the new president? He actually used the phrase three times, Covenant Path. So I think that's kind of where it connected with the members. And they're like, oh, yeah, he's going to talk about this, the Covenant Path. Okay, Bill brought this up. Think celestial. This is the new phrase. This is what everybody's saying. I did a podcast about all the merch associated with this. It's on beach towels and bags and mugs and water bottles and sweatshirts, umbrellas, doormats. It's everywhere. Anywhere you can think to put the words think celestial, it's going to be there. So there were 17 citations of the catchphrase think celestial with Elder Rasband actually saying it 11 times. Did you guys catch that? I mean, I watched conference, but did he say it 11 times in a row like a charm? I don't know what he was possibly saying.
I don't watch conference. RFM does it for me.
Bill steps away. I know. RFM does it for all of us. That's right. I watched one.
Elder Rasband says it like kids say Bloody Mary in front of the mirror.
Thanks, Celestial. Thanks. That's what I wondered. If he was chanting it like him. I did that Bloody Mary thing when I was a teenager. I grew up in the 70s. Remember, we all did that. So anyway, so I made a little meme that says, are you just checking in? Are you mentioning my catchphrase in general conference? Right. Because he wants to make sure everybody says it and attributes it to him. So, of course, yes. Oh, go ahead, RFM.
It's just Elder Rasband. I mean, why are you sucking up to this guy? It's not like he can fire you. He can't really demote you. I mean, Elder Uchtdorf got demoted, but he's still an apostle, right?
He did.
If I got called as an apostle, I wouldn't be brown nosing anymore. That would be my green light to tell these suckers what I really think of them.
There's a hierarchy, and I think there are perks, and you got to, you know, make the leader know that you appreciate everything that he's doing. So again, Elder Rasband also credited President Nelson with inventing the phrase think celestial. So did Elder President Nelson, according to Elder Rasband, invent think celestial? Kind of looked into this. So in 1978, Elder Sterling W. Sill first mentioned Think Celestial, and it was in a talk called The Poetry of Success. This was back when talks and addresses were really, really interesting. They quoted poetry, they quoted great literature, and he did say the words Think Celestial in this talk. So this was quite a long time ago.
Nelson was in his 60s then.
Yeah, practically. Yeah. 78, I think it's. Did it say 78? Let me go back. 78.
I think President Nelson is a brick allure.
Yeah. I don't know. I can't decide. Anyway, President Russell M. Nelson used the phrase think celestial for the first time in 2023 in the same talk in which he said the famous words, never take counsel from those who do not believe. So there was a very different reaction to this talk from different segments of Mormonism. Faithful Mormons were really excited about think celestial. The rest of us who are more on the post-Mormon side saw that other phrase, never take counsel from those who do not believe, as being very problematic. So,
yeah, I'm sorry to say this about President Nelson, but I wouldn't believe him if he told me my airplane was on fire.
Oh, oh my goodness, you had to go there. Wow. All right, let's power through. We've got like one or two slides left. So I just couldn't leave it alone. I had to say, where is this phrase from? It's got to be used before. So I went out beyond the corpus of General Conference just for fun to see what I could find. So I found this very interesting beauty product from the late 1700s. It was called Olympian Dew, and it was sort of a rose water. There's a whole advertisement here. Even the Queen of France says, no perfume so sweet and delicate or refreshing as Olympian Dew. So it's some kind of a beauty product. And the reason I'm telling you this is because I found the words Think Celestial in a poem that was kind of written to highlight this Olympian Dew. It's, you know what? I should make you read this, RFM. Can you read this poem for us? It's by Reverend George Crabb.
I will read it the same way President Nelson read it when he was reading it hot off the press.
I want the whistle too.
Come, that's right. Faded
bellies. Who would your youth? Okay, bells. That's what I thought it was the first time I read it.
Come, faded bells.
Who would your youth renew? And learn the wonders of Olympian Sherry Dew. Restore the roses that begin to faint, nor think celestial washes vulgar paint.
Yeah, it's not quite the right context. That's exactly right. There should be a comma.
Your former features, airs, and arts assume Circassian virtues with Circassian bloom.
Isn't that interesting? So that's the only place I found it. So it is a pretty original thought, but not President Nelson's. It belonged to Elder Sills, who did mention it in 1978. But interesting, because now we see it everywhere. It's on every single thing you could possibly imagine. So
the Reverend George Crabb had a famous friend of his back when he was in school. Do you remember what his name was?
No, I don't.
Goyle.
Goyle? Oh, crap. Oh, my God. Oh, no. How did I not get that one? It's a Harry Potter reference. Dang it.
It was a softball. You whipped on it.
That was a softball. I'm not thinking Harry Potter right now. I'm trying to get through my presentation. So, but ooh, that was a good one.
Who's Harry Potter?
Harry Potter's arch nemesis, Draco Malfoy, had two henchmen, Crabbe and Doyle. So I should have known that. I should.
Or Goyle. Known. I had the corrected version, the second edition.
Yeah, you did.
Not Doyle.
All right. I'm on to my final slide, and then we'll finally be done with all this. Again, I just wanted to make the point that words matter. As we saw here, we can kind of get an idea of the landscape of Mormonism, things that are fading into the past down the memory hole, things that are rising to the top that are going to be really important concepts as we go forward. So if anybody wants entertainment, go over to the General Conference corpus and take a look at all this. And I'd like to thank my friend David for putting all this out there. It's really interesting. So I think that's it. I think we've done it. We've covered everything. Do you guys have anything else to say about any other thing we've covered today, or have we done it?
I have two things to say about yours, Rebecca. Okay. Only this, okay? I'm not sure what your friend Dave meant about the Lamanites thing. I did look up steeple. It gets basically no references under the word steeple at all.
Yep.
And what there are not talking about how they're an essential part of temple worship.
No, that's next conference. I'm going on record right now. Oh, yeah. There's going to be a whole talk about the height. Next conference.
I think that is a very, very good prediction on your part. I do have to mention, though, that Lamanites are all over the place. So I don't know if David meant that in a special kind of context. But for instance, in 2023, you know, there's two mentions of Lamanites. In 2022, there's like four. So I'm not sure what he means.
I think he means that just recently, in the recent, you know, last conference, there was no mention, and it's definitely kind of fading out. Yeah.
Okay, because the most recent was 2023, so nothing in 2024.
Right.
Got it. Okay, thank you. The other thing that I think about is, once again, you know, when Gordon B. Hinckley was asked the question about Joseph Smith teaching that God was once a man. And his response was to equivocate and say, I don't know that we teach that. I don't know that we emphasize that.
Yeah.
I continue to think that that was not just a dodging of the question, but it was a huge tipping of his hand and allowing us to see how it is that church leadership deals with changing doctrines over time, which is simply we stop teaching it or we stop emphasizing it. And I think that's exactly what your research has indicated about certain things in general conference. They stop talking about it when they don't want it emphasized. And then they'll start emphasizing something else. And then everything goes away and nobody's the wiser unless they have the Corpus of LDS General Conference Talks website.
Or watch Mormonism Live.
And Mormonism Live. Yeah. Well, and that's what leads to gaslighting too, because especially somebody like me who's been in the church for over 5 decades, I often hear, oh, that was never a thing. That didn't happen. And I'm like, yes, it was a thing. I mean, that's honestly why I started podcasting, because I thought people of a certain age need to kind of document these things that were realities for whatever it's worth. You know, it really was. You can't gaslight me and tell me that wasn't real. It was. So this helps. Checking the words, checking the language, it does help.
And it does help for generations to die off and not remember how things used to be.
It does.
What's the line at the opening of The Ride of Paul Revere? Hardly a man is still alive who remembers that famous day and year. Yeah, when that happens, now you've got a brand new audience that you can teach a new history to that the older people remembered was not at all what happened. In fact, the opposite of what happened.
Yeah. Yep, and that's important in a religious structure, isn't it? As you kind of change with things, change with the time. Any final thoughts on any of that from you, Bill?
Just to reiterate what's already been said, if Mormonism has changed everything, and Charlie Harrell says it has, Greg Prince has said it has, if everything has changed and nothing is what it was claimed to be, then Mormonism isn't even anything that resembles the Mormonism that was restored originally when the restoration was mostly complete. As Gordon B. Hinckley said, there were maybe from time to time we'll have to seek out something, but for the most part, whatever we have behind us is enough to go on. And now we have an ongoing restoration where everything can continue to change at a picked up pace. There's no way to even anymore weigh Mormonism against Mormonism. It's so different today than it was in 1830 or 1840 or 1860. And members sort of have this idea that God is unchanging, he's eternal, nothing has gone by the wayside. And in reality, every single doctrine has transitioned, been rebranded, repurposed, or abandoned.
Yeah, the only unchanging thing about Mormonism is that it changes.
Yeah.
And God bless your mom, Rebecca, for remembering how things used to be and you saying ongoing restoration and her going, no, this does not compute. Yeah. This is not the Mormonism that I know and love. And yet it's the Mormonism that they are starting to insinuate into the brand. And it would be possible, like, who's the guy who fell asleep for, what was it, 20 years?
Rip Van Winkle,
right? Yeah. You know, he dies when America's in the colonial stage. And after he wakes up after the Revolutionary War is over and he goes into a tavern, says, God save the king, and almost gets crap beat out of him, thrown out of the tavern, right?
Yeah.
But if you were a Mormon who is not paying attention or who somehow went to sleep 20 years ago in the year 2004 even, okay? And you woke up today, you would say, what is this church? Mm-hmm. Because it has changed so much. It changes incrementally over time. But if you take 20 years and you go to sleep or you leave it and you come back and you say, what on earth? This is not the Mormon church that I remember from 20 years ago.
Yeah. And that's why I question why they always use the phrase absolute truth. That's another one I would like to look up. Maybe somebody can. Absolute truth. Because what is an absolute truth? What is God's absolute truth in Mormonism? Things change. Everything is changing constantly. Maybe that's the truth, that everything changes. So
Richard Bushman said that the dominant narrative isn't true and that the church will have to rewrite its narrative. And folks, you are watching that happen in real time.
Yeah. Well, absolute truth is really, it's going up in value. So I don't know if now is a good time to buy, but just in 2024, so this past April, it's the only 2024 we have. It was mentioned 3 times by 2 different speakers. It was mentioned by Neil Anderson in 2023, mentioned 4 times in 2022, and again in 2021. There really is absolute truth, Russell M. Nelson told us in 2021, eternal truth.
Yeah. So interesting. So yeah, everybody go out and look at this. It's called the LDS General Conference Corpus. Hopefully we can all maybe link it in the show notes for people, but it's a fascinating deep dive. And I'm sure you all have things that you're curious about personally. And please share in the comments what you find, because it's interesting. All right, I think we've done it. Let's ask RFM, what's coming up this week for you?
I thought you were going to ask me to give the closing prayer for a second. I had a
I know. We'd like to ask you. No, I'm a woman. I can't ask someone to give the closing prayer. What, are you kidding?
You're right. What was I thinking? Bill was folding his arm. Bill is the reverence boy. He's the reverence child up there in front of the chapel.
Oh, the reverence child. Yeah, that's it. So anyway, what's going on? What's going on?
We can't even keep track. We're coming loose at both ends, burning the midnight oil.
So much.
And Wednesday night, a marvelous work has been working overtime to produce something. They're part four. And it's episode four, but episode three was nothing except about Jesus, you know, for Easter. Right. And when I say nothing about, it was only about Jesus, I don't mean to diminish the figure of Jesus. I just mean that they weren't even talking about evidence, which is the whole raison d'etre for their existence, for the production of these. A marvelous work. Remember, it was called How Great the Evidence.
Yes.
That's the subtitle. And so this is part three in the sense of this is the one we're going to cover, because why cover something that doesn't really talk about any evidence? That seems pointless.
Right. This is our part three.
Yeah, so this is our part three on the episode they just dropped last Sunday. That's yesterday. Wow, we are really on top of things, Bill. This is amazing. We're going to be covering this on Wednesday night. How can we possibly do that without, you know, staying up until all hours?
Well, have watched it. I've watched it. By the way, we're going to have Rebecca Biblioteca on as a guest co-host for that episode. And as we dive into this, we've all watched it. I finished it about an hour ago. Yes.
Don't tell us what you think.
There are plenty of good things to go into. And I've already got some images in the slideshow. We'll have a lot of fun with this one.
Oh, really? Yeah, I've got lots of great thoughts, because this is really, really, really uninspiring.
Yes.
And it looks like, you know, Scott Christopher.
Yeah.
Scott Christopher is looking more and more distraught with each thumbnail.
Yeah.
A little weathered.
I was going to say, the only reason I get to be on Mormonism Live is because I was ranting and raving and gnashing my teeth about this episode to RFM today. And I think he knew that I needed a place to put it all. So thank you.
You're welcome. And it will be great to have you on the show on Wednesday so you can tell us about it. No, Sunday morning, she's texting me saying, have you watched this? And yeah. I'm just rolling out of bed. Thank you. And she says, you have to watch it so I have someone to talk with about it. Well, you'll have a few thousands of people to talk with about it on Wednesday evening, Rebecca, along with both of them.
That is great. And then as far as anything else, RFM, do you have any Shakespeare or Sunday school coming out this week?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, Shakespeare will probably be Sunday, and I'll get to Hamlet Act 3, Scene 4, I think it is. And
awesome.
Gertrude's Closet. Yeah.
I don't remember that from Shakespeare. Okay.
It's her chambers.
I was going to say her chambers.
Anyway, it's going to get really Freudian.
There you go. You heard it here. Anything else from you, Bill, as far as what's coming up?
No, I'm just trying to keep one foot in front of the other right now. So
no, I know. All of us were talking about that today. It's like, whew, oh my gosh. So let me think. What do I have on tomorrow night? We always drop an episode at 6 p.m. We have the amazing Ganesh Shurian with a lengthy episode, but really interesting, that says, was Mormonism an accident? Such an interesting conversation. Absolutely fascinating. You might want to tune in for that. So that'll be really good.
That's on Mormonish, right, Rebecca?
That's on Mormonish podcast. That's right. Exactly. And then on Friday on Mormonish, I'll say this just because a lot of people have been asking me, the Reader's Theater that we put on live in Provo back on March 17th, it's a play called The Beehive State about post-manifesto polygamy, which is a hot topic right now, written by the amazing Rob Lauer. We have the copy. It's a video of that Reader's Theater, and we're going to drop that on Friday morning. So that is going to be something you don't want to miss. It's absolutely fabulous. So lots of good stuff going on. So I think we did it. We'd like to thank everybody for tuning into the Mormon Newscast, and thank you, RFM, and thank you, Bill. And we'll be right back here again next Monday night, every week, 6 p.m. Mountain Time. So we will see you all next time. Thank you from the Mormon Newscast.